Chapter 16. With us, and are in our island, wherever we go. Toto Deviso Zorbal was separated from the people in the midst of whom we are. When we came to the steamer next morning, the castle crag of Drachenfels rose up in the sunrise before, and looked as pink as the cheeks of Master Jackie, when they have been just washed in the morning. How that rosy light, too, did become Miss Fanny's pretty dimples, to be sure. How good a cigar is at the early dawn. I maintain that it has a flavor which it does not possess at later hours, and that it partakes of the freshness of all nature. And wine, too. Wine is never so good as at breakfast. Only one can't drink it, for tipsiness's sake. See, there is a young fellow drinking soda water and brandy already. He puts down his glass with a gasp of satisfaction. It is evident that he had need of that fortifier and refresher. He puts down the beaker and says, "How are you, Titmarsh? I was so cut last night. My eyes, wasn't I? Not in the least. That's all. It is the youthful descendant and heir of an ancient line. The noble Earl of Grimsby's son, Viscount Talboys. He is traveling with the Rev. Baron Leader, his tutor, who, having a great natural turn and liking towards the aristocracy, and having inspected Lady Kickleberry's cards on her trunks, has introduced himself to her ladyship already, and has inquired after Sir Thomas Kickleberry, whom he remembers perfectly, and whom he had often the happiness of meeting when Sir Thomas was an undergraduate at Oxford. There are few characters more amiable and delightful to watch and contemplate than some of those middle-aged Oxford bucks who hang about the university and live with the young toughs. Leader can talk racing and boating with the fastest young Christchurch gentlemen. Leader occasionally rides to cover with Lord Talboys, is a good shot, and seldom walks out without a setter or a spaniel at his heels. Leader knows the Eurage and the Acing calendar as well as the Oxford cram books. Leader comes up to town and dines with Lord Grimsby. Leader goes to court every 2 years. He is the greatest swell in his common room. He drinks claret, and can't stand port wine any longer, and the old fellows of his college admire him, and pet him, and get all their knowledge of the world and the aristocracy from him. I admire those kind old dons, when they appear affable and jaunty, men of the world, members of the Amford and Oxbridge Club, upon the London pavement. I like to see them over the Morning Post in the common room, with a, I see Lady Rackstraw as another daughter. Appleton there has been at another party at 10. House, and you weren't asked, my boy. Ord Coverdale has got a large party staying at Coverdale. Did you know him at Christchurch? He was a very handsome man, before he broke his nose fighting the bargemen at Iffley. A lightweight, but a beautiful sparrer, and see, let me add that Leader, although he does love a tuft, has a kind heart. As his mother and sisters in Yorkshire know, as all the village knows too, which is proud of his position in the great world, and welcomes him very kindly when he comes down and takes the duty at Christmas, and preaches to them one or two of the very sermons which Lord Grimsby was good enough to like when I delivered them at Talboys. You are not acquainted with Lord Talboys? Leader asks, with a dejudiced air. She'll have much pleasure in introducing you to him. Talboys, let me introduce you to Lady Kickleberry. Sir Thomas Kickleberry was not at Christchurch in your time, but you have heard of him, I dare say. Your son has left a reputation at Oxford. I should think I have to. He walked 100 miles in 100 hours. They said he bet that he'd drink 100 pints of beer in 100 hours. But I don't think he could do it, not strong beer. Don't think any man could. The beer here isn't worth it, my dear Talboys, says Leader, with a winning smile. I suppose Lady Kickleberry is not a judge of beer, and what an unromantic subject of conversation here, under the castle crag immortalized by Byron. What the deuce does it mean about peasant girls with dark blue eyes, and hands that offer corn and wine? Asks Talboys. V.E. never seen any peasant girls, except the ugliest set of women I ever looked at. the poet's license. I see, Milliken, you are making a charming sketch. You used to draw when you were at Brassinus, Milliken, and play, yes, you played the violoncello. Mr. Milliken still possessed these accomplishments. He was taken up that very evening by a soldier at Koblenz for making a sketch of a Rembrandtstein. Mrs. Milliken sketches immensely too, and writes poetry. Such dreary pictures, such dreary poems. But professional people are proverbially jealous, and I doubt whether our fellow passenger, the German, would even allow that Milliken could play the violoncello. Lady Kickleberry gives Miss Fanny a nudge when Lord Talboys appears, and orders her to exert all her fascinations. How the old lady coaxes, and she wheedles. She pours out the Talboys' pedigree upon him, and asks after his aunt and his mother's family. Is he going to Nuremberg? How delightful! There is nothing like British spirits, and to see an English matron well set upon a young man of large fortune and high rank is a great and curious sight. And yet, somehow, the British doggedness does not always answer. Do you know that old woman in the drab jacket, Titmarsh? My hereditary legislator asks of me. What the devil is she bothering me for, about my aunts, and setting her daughter at me? I ain't such a fool as that. I ain't clever, Titmarsh. I never said I was. I never pretend to be clever, and that but why does that old fool bother me, hey? Hago. I'm devilish thirsty. I was devilish cut last night. I think I must have another go off. Hallo you. Kellner. Garçon. Odie soda, odor petit verre du divin de cognac. That's your sort, isn't it, leader? You will speak French well enough, if you practice, says leader with a tender voice. Practice is everything. Shall we dine at the table d'hôte? Waiter. Put down the name of Viscount Talboys and Mr. Leader, if you please. The boat is full of all sorts and conditions of men. Ford, there are peasants and soldiers. Stumpy, placid-looking little warriors for the most part, smoking feeble cigars and looking quite harmless under their enormous helmets. A poor stunted dull-looking boy of 16, staggering before a black-striped sentry box, with an enormous musket on his shoulder, does not seem to me a martial or awe-inspiring object. Has it not been said that we carry our prejudices everywhere, and only admire what we are accustomed to admire in our own country? Yonder walks a handsome young soldier who has just been marrying a wife. How happy they seem! And how pleased that everybody should remark their happiness. It is a fact that in the full sunshine, and before a couple of hundred people on board the Joseph Miller steamer, the soldier absolutely kissed Mrs. Soldier, at which the sweet Fanny Kickleberry was made to blush. We were standing together looking at the various groups. The pretty peasant woman, really pretty for once, with the red headdress and fluttering ribbons, and the child in her arms, the jolly fat old gentleman, who was drinking Rhine wine before noon, and turning his back upon all the castles, towers, and ruins, which reflected their crumbling peaks in the water, upon the handsome young students who came with us from Bonn, with their national colors in their caps, with their picturesque looks, their yellow ringlets, their budding mustaches, and with cuts upon almost every one of their noses, obtained in duels at the university. Most picturesque are these young fellows, indeed, but why need they have such black hands? Near us is a type too. A man who adorns his own tail, and points his own moral. Under, in his carriage, sits the Count de Rienick, who won't travel without that dismal old chariot, though it is shabby, costly, and clumsy, and though the wicked red Republicans come, and smoke under his very nose. Yes, Miss Fanny, it is the lusty young Germany, pulling the nose of the worn-out old world. La, what do you mean, Mr. Titmarsh? Cries the dear Fanny. And here comes Mademoiselle de Rienick, with her companion. You see, she is wearing out one of the faded silk gowns which S.E. has spoiled at the residence during the season. For the Rienicks are economical, though they are proud, and forced, like many other insolvent grandees, to do and to wear shabby things. It is very kind of the young countess to call her companion Louis, apostrophe and to let Louis call her Laura. But if faces may be trusted, and we can read in one countenance conceit and tyranny, deceit and slyness in another, dear Louis has to suffer some hard raps from dear Laura. And, to judge from her dress, I don't think poor Louis has her salary paid very regularly. What a comfort it is to live in a country where there is neither insolence nor bankruptcy among the great folks, nor cringing, nor flattery among the small. Isn't it, Miss Fanny? Miss Fanny says that she can't understand whether I am joking or serious, and her mama calls her away to look at the ruins of Wittgenstein. Everybody looks at Wittgenstein. You are told in Murray to look at Wittgenstein. Lankin, who has been standing by, with a grin every now and then upon his sardonic countenance, comes up and says, Titmarsh, how can you be so impertinent? Impertinent? As how? The girl must understand what you mean, and you shouldn't laugh at her own mother to her. Did you ever see anything like the way in which that horrible woman is following the young lord about? See? You see it every day, my dear fellow. Only the trick is better done, and Lady Kicklebury is rather a clumsy practitioner. See, why nobody is better aware of the springes which are set to catch him than that young fellow himself, who is as knowing as any veteran in Mayfair. And you don't suppose that Lady Kicklebury fancies that she is doing anything mean, or anything wrong. Heaven bless you, she never did anything wrong in her life. As he has no idea but that everything she says, and thinks, and does is right. And no doubt she never did rob a church, and was a faithful wife to Sir Thomas, and pays her tradesmen. Confound her virtue! It is that which makes her so wonderful, that brass armor in which she walks impenetrable, not knowing what pity is, or charity, crying sometimes when she is vexed, or thwarted, but laughing never. Cringing, and domineering by the same natural instinct, never doubting about herself above all. Let us rise, and revolt against those people, Lankin. Let us war with them, and smite them utterly. It is to use against these, especially, that scorn and satire were invented. And the animal you attack, says Lankin, is provided with a hide to defend him. It is a common ordinance of nature. And so we pass by tower and town, and float up the Rhine. We don't describe the river. Who does not know it? How you see people asleep in the cabins at the most picturesque parts, and angry to be awakened when they fire off those stupid guns for the echoes. It is as familiar to numbers of people as Greenwich, and we know the merits of the inns along the road as if they were the Trafalgar or the Tar and Garter. How stale everything grows. If we were to live in a Garden of Eden now, and the gate were open, we should go out, and tramp forward, and push on, and get up early in the morning, and push on again, anything to keep moving, anything to get a change. Anything but quiet for the restless children of Cain. So many thousands of English folks have been at Regentenwarborg in this and last seasons, that it is scarcely needful to alter the name of that pretty little gay, wicked place. There were so many British barristers there this year that they called the Odel de Quarter Sessions the Odel of Quarter Sessions. There were judges and their wives, sergeants and their ladies, Queen's Counsel learned in the law, the Northern Circuit and the Western Circuit. There were officers of half pay and full pay, military officers, naval officers, and sheriff's officers. There were people of high fashion and rank, and people of no rank at all. There were men and women of reputation, and of the two kinds of reputation. There were English boys playing cricket, English pointers putting up the German partridges, and English guns knocking them down. There were women whose husbands, and men whose wives were at home. There were high church and low church England turned out for a holiday, in a word. How much farther shall we extend our holiday ground, and where shall we camp next? A winter at Cairo is nothing now. Perhaps ere long we shall be going to Saratoga Springs, and the Americans coming to Margate for the summer. apartments befitting her dignity and the number of her family, had been secured for Lady Kickleberry by her dutiful son, in the same house in which one of Lankin's friends had secured for us much humbler lodgings. Kickleberry received his mother's advent with a great deal of good humor, and a wonderful figure the good-natured little baronet was when he presented himself to his astonished friends, scarcely recognizable by his own parent and sisters, and the staring retainers of their house. "Mercy, Kickleberry! Have you become a Red Republican?" his mother asked. "I can't find a place to kiss you," said Miss Fanny, laughing to her brother. And he gave her pretty cheek such a scrub with his red beard, as made some folks think it would be very pleasant to be Miss Fanny's brother. In the course of his travels, one of Sir Thomas Kickleberry's chief amusements and cares had been to cultivate this bushy auburn ornament. He said that no man could pronounce German properly without a beard to his jaws, but he did not appear to have got much beyond this preliminary step to learning. And, in spite of his beard, his honest English accent came out, as his jolly English face looked forth from behind that fierce and bristly decoration, perfectly good-humored and unmistakable. "We try our best to look like foreigners, but we can't. Every Italian mendicant or pont-neuf beggar knows his Englishman in spite of blouse, and beard, and slouched hat. Here's a peculiar high-bred grace about us," I whisper to Lady Kickleberry, "an aristocratic genius case quoi, which is not to be found in any but Englishmen. And it is that which makes us so immensely liked and admired all over the continent." Well, this may be truth or joke, this may be a sneer or a simple assertion. Our vulgarities and our insolences may, perhaps, make us as remarkable as that high breeding which we assume to possess. It may be that the continental society ridicules and detests us, as we walk domineering over Europe. But, after all, which of us would denationalize himself, who wouldn't be an Englishman? Come, sir, cosmopolite as you are, passing all your winters at Rome or at Paris, exiled by choice, or poverty, from your own country, preferring easier manners, cheaper pleasures, a simpler life. Are you not still proud of your British citizenship, and would you like to be a Frenchman? Kickleberry has a great acquaintance at Noirbourg, and as he walks into the great concert room at night, introducing his mother and sisters there, he seemed to look about with a little anxiety, lest all of his acquaintance should recognize him. There are some in that most strange and motley company with whom he had rather not exchange salutations under present circumstances. Pleasure seekers from every nation in the world are here, sharpers of both sexes, wearers of the stars and cordons of every court in Europe, Russian princesses, Spanish grandees, Belgian, French, and English nobles, every degree of Britain, from the ambassador, who has his conch, to the London apprentice who has come out for his fortnight's lark. Kickleberry knows them all, and has a good-natured nod for each. "Who is that lady with the three daughters who saluted you?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.